Thanks. Okay. Good to see you guys all again. So from what I understood from our discussion is that for this particular year anyway, we're going to leave Masechet Kiddushin and try and get a bit of chizuk going and try and see by looking at the parashiyot that we're reading now. If we dig a little bit deeper, we start to get an appreciation of the personalities that make up Sefer Bereishis. Now, you're well aware of the principle that the Ramban makes famous, where the Ramban and other Rishonim, they essentially encourage us to look at Sefer Bereishit as kind of like the blueprint for all of Jewish history. In other words, it's like the spiritual DNA, the original gene pool spiritually that exists within Klal Yisrael, in fact, in the world in general. And therefore, we need to study it because we will be taught through the stories in Bereshit. We'll be taught what's going to happen, throughout Jewish history. It's just going to repeat itself. Different machinations, of what we're going to see in our history. And so therefore it's an interesting exercise because when we look through the Sedras, Parshat Vayera, Chayesara that we've just gone through, we'll start to see patterns emerge, and we appreciate them so much more because we're living through a time which is actually spoken about in already, so to speak, predicted from the word go. So you've asked that we do this. We learn le is it Ilu Nikmat?
No, refer,
A
refer.
Refuah Shleima for Miriam Bat Chana. Okay. Have a Refuah Shleima. Our learning should be a big schut for all those who need a Refuah Shleima. So we're going to do this exercise, which the Ramban expresses in the following words, where he says, "Mashi'ira la'avot," whatever happened to the patriarchs and matriarchs, "ira la'banim." Some of us colloquially related as "Ma'ase avot siman la'banim," maybe an easier phrase to say. "Ma'ase avot," what happened? The actual deeds that happened. Or that were performed by the characters in Sefer Bereishit create like a ripple effect, a mirror image throughout all of history. So whoever was sitting at the beginning of time is like that original gene for good and for bad. And then that creates a ripple effect throughout all of the generations that follow from there, either to add or to fix up. And these parashiyot are just loaded with unbelievable depth. And as I say, our specific aim here is to have a look at the nature of our confrontation with with Ishmael, since we are mamash living it, in real time. Now, let me begin the story by working with a principle that the Ramban speaks out, and it's a bit of a, I would say it's an uncomfortable chiddush that the Ramban offers us. Simply trying to understand the enmity that exists between Yishmael and Yitzchak, between Arab and Jew. Where did all that come from? Well, what set that off? So the Ramban claims that Sarah Imenu's oppression or abuse of Hagar created this unique level of enmity. So there's hatred, and then there's like unique hatred. And says the Ramban that Sarah did something that was on her level problematic. Problematic. And now not everybody agrees with the Ramban, but he says it. So, if somebody like Ramban says it, you're sort of like, okay, you try and think along those lines to see, what lesson are we meant to learn from that? So I'd just like to offer a personal suggestion. I'm open to being wrong, but I want to just, use the idea to try and identify, what did Sarah do that was incorrect? So again, the Ramban told us that she oppressed Hagar. As a result of that, Hagar left. Ishmael inherited that so-called, abuse or the attitude towards the abuse, and he harbored that in his heart and passed it on to his descendants. I would like to suggest something slightly different, and that is as follows: that I'm always bothered by the beginning of the story. So Avraham Avinu and Sarah arrive in Eretz Canaan, in Eretz Israel, and then the famine there forces them down to Mitzrayim. When they approach Mitzrayim, Avraham Avinu is worried about the fate that may potentially accrue to him. He's worried for his life. And he makes a cheshbon, a calculation there, that suggests that he is absolutely confident in the righteousness of Sarah and the holiness of her personality, that he's absolutely confident that she will not be harmed, no matter what. And this supposition is supported by the fact that he has no problem in using her as bait. He knows they're gonna go into a situation. Sarah is one of the most beautiful women ever to face, to grace our scenes, as the Midrashim tell us. And he knows that Paro's gonna chap her. Avimelech later on chaps her the second time. She's held hostage, and the first Jewish hostage is Sarah. And he says, okay, you know what? If they think that I'm married to her, they're gonna kill me. So rather just say that we're brother and sister, and that way they'll respect me, and they want to make the shidduch work, and they don't want the brother offside. So they want to then, side up with the brother and give him all sorts of wealth, and to make sure the brother doesn't have a problem, with the shidduch, and of his sister being abducted and taken to the king. And everybody tries to ask, how did he do that? Why, bottom line is my understanding based on certain mafoshim is that he knows that Sarah will not be harmed, but he's not so confident about himself. And therefore he needs to do something that will keep him out of harm's way. And in the end it plays itself out according to this pshat that Sarah was completely protected. Anybody came near her, that Avraham Avinu of touching her, there were malochim over there that were just batting them down, And before you knew it, whether they suffered from diseases or they were beaten, whatever it was, any other minute to touch Sarah was they got clobbered. Fine, she's returned to Avraham Avinu. Now, when they leave Egypt, they came down as three major characters. There was Avram, Sarah, and Lot, and they left as four characters. And the fourth character is Hagar. Hagar is an addition to the family. Now, this has always bothered me. How did Hagar get into this position? Like, what was happening over here? In other words, Avraham Avinu certainly didn't ask, for another wife. Not Sarah is the one who initiates the whole thing. Now, we can understand Sarah's sadness, frustration at not being able to have a child, despite the promise that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to Avraham and Sarah that they would have children. It must have been unbelievable to bear such a story. And possibly as a result of that unbearable fact, Sarah was sad on two levels. Level number one is personally not being able to have a child. And number two, who's going to be the, you know, the continuum of Avraham Avinu's legacy? And so I wonder if it's possible to suggest that as a result of a lack of emuna in the original vision, that there will be a child to you and Avraham Avinu. And no matter how unlikely it seems, and to him will inherit the land of Eretz Israel, and he will be the continuity of the Jewish people to the exclusion of anybody else. That's the original vision. And quite possibly, Sarah's emuna in that vision is being challenged to the point where she says to herself, as the Torah reports, it's not happening. And therefore, maybe what HaKadosh Baruch Hu meant was that it's through my shlichut, through my aegis, through my proxy, that the continuum of Klal Yisrael will take place. It's like if I'm the mishaleach, if I'm the person who sets up the relationship with somebody else, I acquire a slave. That slave is now my property. I give that slave to my husband as a wife, a de facto wife, let's say, and then the child that's born through that, you know, that will be the continuity. Maybe that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu meant. And if this suggestion is taken to the next level, she finds something unique in the palace. Yeah, she's like, where did she even find Agar? Was she like, you know, she doesn't set up a psychology practice with a shingle on the door saying, you know, looking for the next Jewish princess here. You know, what happened there? We don't know any of the stories. I mean, I haven't seen in the Midrashim explicit stories. I need to look obviously further, but my idea is that she, when Klal Yisrael or anybody that is holy is in a tension, is in a crisis, is fighting for the future of Klal Yisrael, there's a kind of a war on, you know, the holy people will be able to perceive that there are neshamas that need to be rescued, that want to join Klal Yisrael, that just don't know how to get out of their matzav that they're in. And therefore, it's possible that in the palace, while she was there, she sees a girl, you know, looking at her differently with different eyes. And there's kind of a communication without saying anything. I mean, I'm assuming all of this. I can't even prove it, but the end result makes sense if you work with such a theory, that possibly she sees in Hagar, you know, a person who's looking for something in the world of spirituality. And she maybe engages her in conversation, minimal as it may have been. But in the end of the day, Hagar becomes a convert to monotheism. And she gives up her life as a princess. Hagar is Paro's daughter. So she gives up her life as a princess to become a maidservant, you know, to Sarah, in order to then be part of the family. And I mean, Hagar, who's looking for something spiritual and is open to it, you know, she's won the lottery. She's been rescued from the pagan halls of Paro, where she herself recognizes that there's no future for her here. And she's been rehabilitated spiritually to become a monotheist and have Avraham Avinu as her partner, as her husband. Imagine, and she can have Avraham Avinu's child. It's poshut. If you were Hagar and you were a spiritual person, and out of nowhere, Sarah reached out and rescued you from spiritual deprivation and built you up and gave you a platform upon which to excel, in which to grow, which to contribute to the world through a child with Avraham Avinu. I mean, you literally have won the lottery. Now, this idea is sort of supported by the fact that the psukim tell you that Sarah says, Abraham's not having a child with me. Maybe he'll have a child with her. And that way there we'll save the Jewish nation. We'll have continuity. So that's why I'm looking into this pasuk and developing a thought that sounds like this is possible. Now, the Mefarshim point out that Masha Avot Siman Rabbanim, which means Avram Avinu and Sarah went down to Mitzrayim. Sarah was taken hostage, eventually released. Upon her release, Avram Avinu showered with wealth, and Hagar joins the family. Now, that's it. That's not the original gene pool. Generation two. Where's the Siman Labanim? When did it happen to Am Yisrael? Well, Am Yisrael go down to Mitzrayim, you know, Sefer Shmot. They're all in Mitzrayim. They're all, so to speak, taken hostage and enslaved. Yitziat Mitzrayim then follows. After the plagues smash Mitzrayim, like the Malachim smashed Paro to let Sarah go, Am Yisrael then, Yaitu Birchush Gadol, they leave with a lot of wealth. Whether the wealth is money or the wealth is Torah, however you want to interpret based on the Mefarshim, but they leave with Rechush Gadol. And now who would you say represents Hagar in Mitzrayim, in the Yitziat Mitzrayim story? So we have all the variables Siman Labanim, but who would you say Hagar represents in that story? Who joined Klal Yisrael, right, when they were leaving Mitzrayim? Well, who joined them was none other than the Erev Rav. Now the Erev Rav, all those convertees that HaKadosh Baruch Hu possibly warned Moshe Rabbeinu, don't encourage them, don't rescue anybody. If you know, I'm on top of it, and Moshe Rabbeinu's in his well-meaning Rachmonis wants to save people. If they're willing to come, let's take them with us. We can rehabilitate them spiritually. We can give them we can give them something. Can rebuild them. They can be part of Klal Yisrael. The Erev Rav is the counterpart to Hagar, and that's who attached themselves to Am Yisrael as they left. And just as you know, just as Paro was overwhelmed by Sarah's ability to call upon HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his Malachim to protect her from his advances, so too the mirror image is the Erev Rav, who were dazzled by the display of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Nisim V'Niflaot in Mitzrayim and wanted to join the Jewish people. Now that's the Ma'ase Avot Siman Labanim in this particular story. Okay, fine. But let's go back now to the original story, you know, to the Ma'ase Avot. What does it look like? So Hagar joins the family, right? Now, Hagar, her attitude to Sarah flips. Now, Rashi tells us that what happens to her is that as soon as Hagar and Avram are intimate, she conceives straight away. And all of a sudden, as a result of that chesed of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that she was able to have children straight away, it set off a thought process in Hagar's mind. And Rashi quotes it and says that, you know, all of a sudden, Hagar says to herself, you know, I've always thought of Sarah as this unbelievably holy tzedeket. And maybe I've got it all wrong. Maybe just her externals are like that. But internally, maybe it's not like that. I mean, if she was so worthy, then how come, you know, she can't have a child? Maybe, you know, if she was a real tzaddeket, she would merit a child. And here I come into this thing and I conceive immediately. And this Yetzer Hara challenges Hagar all the time. And the sad reality is that she cannot resist this Yetzer Hara. It overwhelms her. And eventually she believes it and adopts it. And she starts to belittle Sarah. She starts to look at Sarah, you know, as if the roles are reversed. I'm now the matriarch. I'm pregnant. I'm going to have a son. I mean, she was told she's going to have a son. And we are the continuity of the Jewish people. My son is the Bechor. My son is going to receive a double portion. You know, we are the continuum of Avram's legacy. And that Yetzirah played with Hagar, and she adopted it, unfortunately, hook, line, and sinker. And so eventually, this terrible shift in Hagar's personality and the ego that ran away with this idea motivated her abuse of Sarah. And I say, yeah, you have this holy woman, Sarah, who gave her everything, rescued her from spiritual oblivion to actually rehabilitate her and give her a life. We're talking about from a spiritual point of view, physical too, because Avraham Avinu, of course, could provide her. He was wealthy now, could provide her with everything she needed. You know, but from a spiritual point of view, more than anything else, she has Avraham Avinu's child with her. So Sarah gives her everything. Sarah basically abdicates her position as being the matriarch of the family, gives Hagar life, gives her parnosa, gives her support, gives her status, gives her the spiritual lottery, gives her everything. And this chutzpaniak turns on Sarah and abuses her, makes her life a misery. So eventually Sarah responds, you know, by trying to put her back in her place. And the Midrashim tell her that she increases Hagar's workload until eventually Hagar can't take it anymore and says, I'm out of here. And she runs away to the Midbar. While she's in the desert, the Malach comes to see her and tells her that the Malach tries to tell her, you're nothing without Sarah. You're nothing without being under the umbrella of Avraham Avinu's home. In other words, you think you're now a big deal, but you're not. You have to go back there and tolerate Sarah taking it out on you. Now, it's interesting to work out when the Malach told her to go back, you know, to Sarah. Did the Malach justify Sarah's behavior and say that Sarah was correct in doing what she did? Or was he saying that despite Sarah being wrong and being too harsh on you, it's worth it. You've got to go back there. I don't know the answer to that. But all I know is what the Ramban says. So as far as the Ramban is concerned, the angel wasn't justifying Sarah's behavior because the Ramban thinks that Sarah made a mistake. So therefore, according to the Ramban, you know, okay, despite the fact that Sarah's overdoing it against you, it's still worth it. It's still worth it for you to go back there. According to the other Mefarshim, who don't buy the Ramban's thesis that Sarah sinned. So what would you say is the sin of Sarah then? You know? Anyway, so this is what I was taking a bit of license to try and find another mistake. And maybe it's the same mistake. Maybe the Midrash means to tell you, that's the same mistake. But the real mistake, in my humble opinion, is how on earth do you bring Hagar into the family in the first place? Well, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised you. Now, I know a normal human being, any one of us, when you have to wait 70 plus years to fulfill your promise. I mean, Sarah's 90 when she gives birth to Yitzchak. I don't know what age exactly she got married. You might be able to work that out. But bottom line is, like, you know, she got married young. It's like 80 years waiting for this promise to happen. Of course, anybody, any normal person, you know, even a majorly great person would have a problem. But we're talking about Sarah. And if the Ramban has opened up an avenue to learn a lesson from Sarah's, somehow Sarah's mistake. So maybe we can suggest, you know, there's a certain lack of emunah in the original vision, and Sarah reinterprets the vision to still allow her to be the shaliach, you know, for the continuity. And she finds Hagar, who's spiritually got major potential, And she brings Agar into the fold. What was she doing? I mean, look what happened. Hagar starts to see herself as the matriarch and Sarah as the shivcha. And it gets worse. You know, it gets worse because from the time that Ishmael is born, there's 13 years that Hagar indoctrinates Ishmael with this idea, with this notion that he is the Bechor, he is the chosen child, he's going to get a double portion, he's going to inherit Eretz Israel, and he's the continuum of Avram's legacy. And this is what Hagar drills into Ishmael. It must have been a real shock to Hagar when Avram Avinu must have told her or relays to her Akosh Baruch Hu's prophecy, which re-emphasizes his pledge and promise to them. You know, that Ki b'Yitzchak ikarei lecha Zara, that through Yitzchak and Yitzchak's going to come from you and Sarah. Okay, Avram can't have a child, Sarai can't have a child, but Avraham can and Sarah can, and that's the end of the story. You know, now there's an opportunity over here for Hagar to do tshuva, an opportunity, and say, okay, you know what? Look at this unbelievable miracle. Look at this unbelievable. I was wrong. I thought Sarah was unworthy. The biggest nace happened over here. 90-year-old lady, you know, has a baby. And she could have done tshuva. But unfortunately, it wasn't to be. And therefore, in Bereishis Chaf Aleph, at the end of the Sidra, when we look at the Loshon of the Psukim, you know, the pastor comes along and says that Sarah sees the son of Agar, the Egyptian, that she bore to Avram Avinu, was mitzachek, you know, engaged in illicit behavior. And whenever you see Yishmael being referred to, it's always referred to as Ben Hagar, because he was indoctrinated by her. And this turned him into who he was. Now, this little word, mitzachek, which is translated literally as mocking, yeah, the Midrashim and the Mephoshim go to town. This is, of course, the understatement of the year. Mocking. He wasn't just mocking. Mocking means that he was rejecting all those values. He rejects the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach, and he engages in violation of all of them. You know, he engages in Avodah Zorah, in Giloy Arayot, in Shvichut Damim, you know, idolatry, adultery, and murder. That guy is like turned into an absolute mafioner. Like the chaps literally become exactly what monotheism, what Torah is, the opposite. Whatever it is, opposite. Okay, and his relationship with Yitzchak. As soon as Yitzchak, he tries to kill him. So at first he starts off by just verbally, you know, criticizing him and mocking him and taunting him about the inheritance, the Bechor, and he's going to get the double portion. But eventually he starts to find ways. I mean, I'm interpreting the Midrash. The Midrash says that he started shooting arrows at, you know, in the direction of Yitzchak. So I'm interpreting that Midrash a bit. You know, we expand it. He started like, you know, with a bit of terrorism. You know, he started like, you know, eventually there'll be a trigger where he'll be able to justify killing him. And Sarah sees all of this. She sees it in its early stages. And Sarah comes to Avram Avinu and says, you know, seriously, if we carry on harboring these two people, they'll kill Yitzchak. They're already violating everything we stand for. There's no good's going to come out of these people. Avram Avinu eventually, as hard as it is for him, you know, Akush Baruch Hu tells him, Sarah's right. You got to get rid of him. Now the Ramban has to interpret that. The Ramban has to try to tell you that, you know, Akush Baruch Hu, even though Sarah was wrong at this level of censorship towards them, the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Avram Avinu, listen to what Sarah says, once you start with free choice, going down, of course, Baruch allows it to carry on, even if it's not right. But the Poshet Pshat of the Psukim don't sound like that. The Poshet Pshat sound like Sarah was right in the end, and therefore send him away. You know, it looks like it's cruel on the face of it, but it's actually it's kind to Klal Yisrael. You can't tolerate this kind of terrorism. And we see that Avraham Avinu, let's say Avraham Avinu accepts Sarah's interpretation, because when he sends Ishmael away, he sends him only with bread and water. He doesn't send him with gold and silver. You know, and the Psukim say again, you know, this Ben Hagar, the Mitzri, that she bore to Avraham Avinu, right? You know, what's the Psukim telling you all the time? The son of Hagar, the Egyptian. Because Hagar bears direct responsibility for Ishmael's slide into degeneracy. She degraded Sarah in Ishmael's eyes, and she neutralized any hashpa, any influence that Sarah would have over Ishmael, and killed any potential for tshuva. And Hagar and Ishmael degenerates into this murderer, into this absolute gangster. And this is what happens because Hagar was brought into the family by Sarah. Now, what you know, right now we're sitting in this awful predicament. The Midas Adin is massive against us here. And we're sitting in a war with Ishmael. I mean, in my humble opinion, right, if you just look at the parallels, comes the you know, the late 1800s, you have people in Eretz Israel, the majority are probably Arabs or Arabs. There's a minority of Jews who've been there all the time, but there's Jews there. But what kind of a life are they living? They're living in abject poverty. There's no running water. It's malaria infested. There's hardly a place that's working in Eretz Israel. You read all the accounts of all the various, academics or missionaries, who went to visit Eretz Israel in the middle of the 1800s, the Mark Twains of the world, and all these chevra, and they write in their diaries, they have never seen such barren wasteland as Eretz Israel. They were religious as well, these chevra, right? So they could feel the Bible's curse, you know, playing itself out in the barrenness of Eretz Israel. And then all of a sudden, you know, Am Yisrael start to return in drips and drabs, and before you know it, you know, we've dried out the swamps and we've created agricultural settlements, kibbutzim, and we've offered the Arabs to stay there and given them equal rights and allowed them to benefit from the whole infrastructure of Eretz Israel, etc. And that's in the 20s, right? And as Am Yisrael goes further and further, you know, as we grow more as a nation, life is better for everybody. And then the chutzpah of these hilarious to develop an ideology, instead of saying thank you to Sarah for giving them a platform to which they could have a better life, we gave them everything. No set of Arabs had better than these guys living in the domain of Jews. And they turn on us as if, like, you know, the shifcha has become the matriarch, as if the land is theirs and they've always been there and they made it work. And it's an unbelievable chutzpah. It's exactly what's happened to Hagar did to Sarah. Same thing. And then indoctrinated Ishmael out of any possible, goodness and recognition, HaKoros HaToy, for what was done for them. And ever since that time, you know, the Ishmael and the Hagars of the world have just been taking everything we offer them, you know, from any advancement in technology to medicine to anything that works. And they just, you know, it makes no difference to them. It's as if, you know, we aren't even, yeah, Sarah didn't even exist. That's the chutzpah. That's what's playing itself out over here. And again, you know, I'm open to corrections here, but in my humble opinion, what do we extract from this? What do we learn from this? We learn from this that if we do not have absolute emunah in the vision that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us, and we start to dilute you know, the mitzvahs HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us with regard to conquering and inheriting Eretz Israel. And we start to come along and play and dilute. Oh, you know what? We'll let the Canaanim remain there. Well, we'll give them equal rights. We'll let them, you know. How can they not appreciate what we do for them? HaKadosh Baruch Hu told you to get rid of these people. They're a cancer, man. They're not meant to be there, Bichlal. And this is not the first time we see it. The whole story of Sefer Yoshua and Shoftim. If you learn through Sefer Yoshua and Shoftim, time and time again, Am Yisrael are given the mitzvah to get rid of the seven Canaanite kingdoms that existed there. There were 31 cultures with all their kings there. However you work out, however you calculate the numbers, you know, seven on one side of the Jordan, three on the other, but there were 31 kings within all of that. You know, it's a bottom line is leave them there at your peril. Whether they come with Avodah Zorah ideology or they come to threaten you, you know, from a security point of view, whatever they do, leaving them there and thinking that everybody will be nice about it, you at your peril. That's one of the main avodas that caused Am Yisrael to lapse into Avodah Zorah. And as a result, HaKadosh Baruch Hu then brings all the different kings to oppress Klal Yisrael all through for 450 years through Sefer Shoftim. It's the same thing. It repeats itself time and time and time again. You know, and from my point of view, I know like I'm a right-wing fanatic, yeah, but I love Begin. You know, Begin's one of my heroes. But Begin is wrong. Begin came and told everybody, you know, as an extension of Jabotinsky's ideology, you know, nothing wrong with democracy. Democracy is fantastic. We've got to tell the Arabs we're not there to conquer them. We're not there to throw them out. We're not there. They're equal rights for everybody. He's wrong. They should never have let them stay there. They should have chased them out, because letting them stay there is inviting peril to the people that are there. There's you don't have to kill them all. You could just push them out. You kill when you have to defend yourself, right? But bottom line is, there's an easy way. Just when the war came of independence, should have let them run. Don't beg them to stay. Don't invite them back. You push them out. You know, create barriers so that they don't come along and influence. Because if you let them stay, you're reaping the problems that you have here. You know, that's an extreme interpretation of what's going on here. You know, this is unfortunately the issue. How many people, all those kibbutzim in the Otef Aza, all of them, the vast majority of them, if not all of them, you know, are all left-wing kibbutzim. They're all coming up with ingenious ways, you know, to help the Palestinians in Gaza, to help them earn a crust, and in order to bring technology back to them. And some of those same chalerias came and murdered us. The very same people, they knew exactly where to go. If this is not a replay of what takes place, Bichlal, in Tanakh, I don't know. I don't know. This is the issue. Again, I don't have the solutions, but I have a personal opinion, but if they're correct or they're practical, that's not my business. But I'll tell you now, in World War, after World War II, reading history, you read that there were so many warring nations. You know, the Hindus and the Shiites and the Pakistan and India and the Greeks and Turkey and Germany and Russia, and you know, everybody was like, you know, was hammering each other out there. You know, okay, so we won and whatever. But now there's all the Soros, right? So what did the world do? What did the League of Nations do after the First World War? What did they try and do? They try to separate out population groups, separate them out. That all the Greeks who are in Turkey should leave, and all the Turks that are in Greece should leave. That way you won't kill each other. And millions of people were forced by these approaches to leave the country of their birth and go and stick it out with their own type so they won't shecht each other. You know, Northern Ireland and Britain, you know, you got to keep them separate. Create different countries if you have to. And millions of people, a lot more than 2 million people, you know, had to go through a population swap, a lot more. This is really what needs to happen over here. If you're asking me, you know, there needs to be a population swap. You know, Azza has to empty out. The world has to take them somewhere and put them somewhere, and Azza has to become Jewish again. And that's the only way, in the end of the day, that you're going to stop this thing happening. And then it's just a matter of time until the Chalerias that are sitting in Yehuda and Shomron or in Lebanon think they're as great as Hamasnik. Same ideology, you know, same sewage, different tap. It's just going to, you know, at some point, if you don't take care of it, it's going to happen. But he has the interesting counterpoint to this whole blurb. Interesting counterpoint here. Comes the end of the Sedra, and we're told that Avraham Avinu's funeral, as you probably know well, Ishmael's there. Ishmael's there. So Rashi quotes the Gemara in Babata, the Gemara there says that who was at the funeral? Yitzchak and Ishmael. Who led the funeral? Yitzchak and Ishmael. The chronology is different. Ishmael's 13 years older. You know, Rashi tells you that Ishmael did tshuva. Ishmael did tshuva. And it's interesting how this tshuva began. When did the tshuva process in Ishmael actually take place? This is the evolution of Ishmael's personality. Well, one could suggest as follows. Avraham Avinu threw Ishmael and Hagar out, right? Now what? Where'd they go from there? How long did it take for him to come back? I don't know the definite answer to this. But we know one thing, and that is that Ishmael was thrown out of Avram's house. Was he 13? Was he 15? When exactly did the story happen, right? He's 13 when Yitzchak is born. He waits for 2 years until he starts his troubles. So that's 15. And I don't know when the story unfolded a bit, but okay, so he's a teenager, right? All of a sudden, the Torah tells us, HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to Avraham Avinu, tests him with the Akedah, and that very morning, Avraham Avinu gets up early, he saddles his donkey, and he takes the Shnei Naravitor, takes the two boys with him. Who the two boys? Eliezer and Ishmael. Ishmael's back. When did Ishmael come back? So you could theorize exactly when he came back. Was he there a couple of years? Because how old is Yitzchak when he's at the Akedah? There are different opinions in various Midrashim. But the opinion that we see, I guess, in the classic Mephoshim is that he's 37 years old. Okay, so Yitzchak's 37. You know, so Ishmael came back by that time. And the fact that the Torah tells you that Avraham Avinu took the two lads with him, I mean, I can't prove it, but it sounds like he's been there for a while. He's back in the Mishpacha. Avraham Avinu accepted him back. What did Sarah have to say about that? We don't know. So theory number one, he accepted him back at a certain point in time. Enough to be part of the family that when the Akedah happens, you know, he's automatically invited to come along. That's theory number one. Theory number two. Is no, that he maybe he came back a couple of days before. And it so happened that the Nisayon of the Akedah happened after Avraham Avinu decided to accept him back. And possibly you could suggest that the reason it happens that way is because when Ishmael comes back to Avraham Avinu and he desperately says, Hatati Aviti Pashati, you know, I want back in. Avraham Avinu allows him back in. You know, now he allows him back in. And the next minute, according to this theory, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avraham Avinu, take him and Eliezer with you and go to Har HaMoriah. Now you could ask yourself, why straight away? If the theory is that he came back a day or two before, or on the night before, you know, maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the Akedah is telling him, okay, take him, you can take him back for a little bit, but you know, his tshuva helps. But he has to know his place. And the only way he's going to understand the difference in spiritual level between himself and where Yitzchak and you are holding is to come with you on the Akedah's journey and to realize that he can't see anything on the top of the mountain. And therefore you tell him, you, the two of you, have to stay here with a donkey, and we're going to meet the Shekhinah. Maybe that's the way to interpret the juxtaposition of Yishmael coming back, doing tshuva, Avraham is accepting him, taking him on the mission. And it's interesting that this understanding fits quite nicely with the lashon of the pasuk. Hashem says to Avraham Avinu, "Kach et bincha yechidcha asher ahavta." Take your son. Which son? I've got two. Your only son. They're both only sons to their mother, asher ahavta, whom you love. I love both of them. What do you mean you love both of them? Must be the tshuva. There must be Avraham Avinu accepted him. So the tshuva process started there. And it's interesting that he mamish the tshuva on all according to the way that we are interpreting here. Now, it's interesting that there's an essay written by Rabbi David Cohen, who I met at a conference many years ago, at a Kiruv conference in America. Anyway, he writes an essay on this. I've sort of used this essay as a basis for this idea. But he says something interesting. He says that Yishmael's tshuva was incomplete. Einachanami did tshuva for the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach. So for the Avodah Zorah and the Shvichut Damim and the adultery, he did tshuva. But there's one element he couldn't do proper tshuva on. He could not recant his denial of Yitzchak's firstbornship, firstborn status. Because this idea that Yitzchak is not the man for the continuum of Avram's legacy, but you are, this idea never left him. It was reinforced by his mother Hagar, and he maintained this claim as Avram's oldest son and the inheritance of Eretz Israel for the rest of his life. And only at the funeral of Avraham Avinu himself, which is an event which the Meforshim encourage us to recognize as what will happen, the Ketz HaYamin, when Mashiach comes, that's when the real tshuva will take place. The real tshuva, meaning the tshuva for this aspect, the second aspect, that the land of Eretz Israel belongs to Yitzchak, and that it's really, Yitzchak, who has all of the Kedusha, etc., that only took place at Avram's burial. And so therefore, there's this interesting chiddush over here that it's possible that Yishmael can do tshuva. Possible. And the fact that tshuva is possible, and it's towards the so-called Ketz HaYamin, that we start to feel it. Look at history. It's interesting that Yishmael does tshuva for idolatry by becoming the Muslims. So towards the end of the Rabbanan, the tkufa of the Rabbanan Savorai, so we're talking, just to round it off, the Gemara is published, Avin and Ravashi, around the year 485, let's call it 500. And then there's Rabbanan Savorai, who edit the Shas to the format we more or less have today. And they, let's say they live they exist for the century after the Shas was, Ravina Nabashi finished the Shas. So they around the year 600, 650. And as the Talmud is closing, all of a sudden, the Arabs now, who until that point were pagan, under the aegis of Muhammad, he leads them to believe in one God. And in that regard, there's an element of tshuva. But the tshuva is not complete, right? The tshuva will only be complete in Mota Mashiach. So what do they do? Well, they can't. The fact that they believe in one God doesn't help us so much. They continue to shecht us because they continue to deny, you know, Yitzchak Avinu's legitimacy to this very day. And just as Ishmael only sees the light at Avram's funeral, the Arab people will do so only when it's Mashiach time. Now, it's interesting. I don't know if you know this, but you can Google it. I did it. You Google, just for an English translation of the Quran's approach to Yitzchak and the story of the Akedah. And you start to Google it and you start to see, can you find some of the translations of the pieces of the Quran? You know, it's really, really, it's fascinating to see that they respect Yitzchak. They call Yitzchak a Muslim because the word Muslim means an Eved Hashem, you know, where you totally give yourself over to being a Kadosh, right? So they, I think there's a reference to him 15 times or something in the Quran, and there's kind of a respectful, very respectful approach to him. But you see that they write there that in the commentaries on the Quran, these people write there, some Jews even believe that he was the one that was sacrificed on the mountain, and that's the continuum of Avraham Avinu's legacy. And from the Quran, they show you that they doctor the whole Tanakh. The story's doctored, and Yishmael's in there. I mean, the Christians have their own late evening edition of the Bible. Okay, fine. They look at really, they interpret pieces in Tanakh in Yeshayahu with a suffering servant and all the stuff that the Christians do. But they didn't really doctor the story of the Old Testament. These guys doctored the story. They doctored the story. They took Yitzchak out, put Ishmael in. So from the very beginning of time, even when they did tshuva, partial tshuva. It's interesting that Rav David Cohen says something interesting. He quotes the Netziv, where the Netziv has an interesting chiddush, where he says like this. He says, you know, Avraham Avinu had 10 tests. And both the Rambam and Rabbeinu Yonah count as two separate trials the two times Sarah was abducted, once by Paro and once by Avimelech. Avimelech is the Plishti, he's from Gerar. He's a Philistine. He's a Palestinian. Now, both trials have common denominators. But the test of Avimelech, the Plishti, adds a new dimension to the abduction. Because it was only after being abducted by Avimelech that Sarah, the promise to Sarah that she would have a child, actually came about. And as a result of the abduction, the talk on the street was that Yitzchak was born to Avimelech. And all of a sudden you see the Arabs start to, Yishmael amplifies this, you know, and all of a sudden there's a fake narrative here. They won't recognize the legitimacy of Yitzchak Avinu. He belongs to, when Avimelech abducted Sarah, he's the product of that union. So then Netziv comes along and says, you know, that, Why did this happen to Sarah? So he suggests along the lines of the Ramban, right? Listen to this. He says that it was a punishment for Sarah's disbelieving laughter upon being told that she would have a son. He seems to say Sarah was punished midah keneged midah. As a result of this, the midah keneged midah punishment was, is that the Erev Rav of the time, you know, the riffraff of that generation said that Yitzchak was not Avraham Avinu's child. And this is exactly what they continue to undermine from then. The Jewish people's claim to the land of Eretz Israel is challenged from the beginning, all the way through till today. It's a thousand years old claim. You know, if Yitzchak was really the son of Avimelech, the Plishti, you know, and all his descendants occupy the land of Israel, so they're all Philistines and they're the heirs to the land and not the heirs of Avraham Avinu. Anyway, as false as this is, This vestige of this claim remains today. Today, still today, you're hearing the same thing that's in Tanakh. You know, this is what we're seeing. So yeah, it's interesting that, you know, the interpretation is as follows: that in our day and age, there are two groups that are disputing Am Yisrael's possession of Eretz Yisrael. There's the Bnei Yishmael, and then there's the Philistines, the Plishtim, the Palestinians. So now there's two tracks here, and these stem both from the two different ways that Yishmael, you know, has treated Am Yisrael, who are Yitzchak Avinu's descendants. The Bnei Yishmael, represented by the Arab world as a whole, they have resigned themselves in the framework of world politics to the necessity of conceding a portion of the land of Israel, you know, to us. On the other hand, there's a group of them, the Palestinians, right, who are represented by all the extremist Hamas, Nikim, Yamach Shamam, and the Islamic Jihad. They won't, it's not about a two-state solution like the Amaratzim Doraisas there in America. I've never seen such clever people be so stupid. Who wants a two-state solution? You think they want a two-state solution? They won't yield one inch because they belong to the Plishti, the Avimelechs. This is the only time that, and quite possibly that we're living in Mashiach times, or at least the so-called Reishit Tzmichat Gulateinu, maybe the Abraham Accords is exactly this. You have a group of people, Arabs, Bnei Ishmael, who are prepared to give legitimacy on a certain level. You know, you can be cynical about it, but it's withstood this particular conflagration, right? Ishmael's doing a bit of tshuva, and therefore it's represented by a track of his descendants. And we have to daven and hope that that we will eventually destroy this enemy that threatens us from within. But there seems to be hope. There seems to be hope, as we see at the end of Parshat Chayei Sarah, where Ishmael at the end of days will do tshuva. But in the meantime, we can't take our chances. We can't take our chances with people who mamash, you know, are prepared to kill Yitzchak. You got to garesh et ha-ma'azot. Get rid of them. Get rid of them. You're not going to have security unless you get rid of them. So you can create a system by which the Torah allows al pi halacha that if a ger toshav, a non-Jewish person, accepts the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach, they can stay. So in my terminology, I would say, forget political rights to the land of Israel. No Arab has any political rights. You have to be a Jew to have political rights. But human rights, human dignity, they have. We have to give it to them. And they're allowed to stay if they believe in the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach. But the minute they violate the principles of Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach, and one of them is to start, you know, murdering Am Yisrael, then they lose their legitimacy to that human right too. And that's the way, you know, I interpret this thing. Anyway, whether it's practically achievable, non-practically achievable, all I can say is that this is like what I'm taking out of, you know, obviously we're all coughing and going mad here, but that's what I'm taking out of this particular story. So anyway, this is a way to interpret it, and we just have to hope that the Reishit Tzmichat Gulateinu flowers into the Gula Amitit, the full Gula, and we should be able to throw off the yoke of our enemies, B'siyat Nishmaya, in Bekarov Mamush. Okay, I'll leave it there. You're welcome to give me feedback. And we should hear better news as each day passes forward.
Thank you so much, Reb Davy. That was unbelievable. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed. Thank you.
Okay, guys. Let me know if you have other comments. Anyway.
When you post the show, a couple of guys have asked for the recording.
Yeah, I'll put it on the group.
Okay.
Okay, Zagabinch, all the best, eh?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers, bye. Cheers.